Quivel lay on the intensive care bed, enclosed by two curtained partitions. An IV bag hung to her left, dripping slowly into a shunt on her arm. Diagnostic scanners monitored her heartbeat and respiration. She twitched fitfully. Reba DeFore stood over her, gently probing her exposed belly with gloved hands. Regardless of how carefully she touched her, the woman's flesh adhered to the latex fingertips. Quivel's body looked as if it were drenched with sweat, and at first DeFore had tried to sponge the moisture away, but strips of her epidermis came up with it. She persevered, simultaneously eyeing the changes of body temperature, erratic heartbeat, and surges of blood pressure on the medical monitor. All DeFore could do was cling grimly to her professional objectivity, no matter how painfully helpless she felt. Although Quivel's respiration was periodically strained, her air passages were unrestricted. The convulsions had diminished to an infrequent trembling in her extremities. DeFore was more concerned about her patient's apparent comatose state, particularly as she entered the first stages of labor. The uterine muscle contractions and the dilation of the cervix seemed normal enough. She had timed the contractions at 20-minute intervals, which to her great relief was strictly textbook. Unfortunately, textbook was the only reference material DeFore possessed in regard to childbirth, new and old human alike. As a medic serving the Ragnarville Magistrate Division, by far the majority of her duties consisted of suturing wounds, setting broken bones, administering medication, and occasionally performing minor surgery. She had never even witnessed a live birth before, much less acted in the role of midwife. She had repeatedly watched a vid of the procedure she found in the Cerberus tape and DVD library when it became likely Quivel would carry her baby to term in the redoubt. But the tape hadn't dealt with a woman suffering either from eclampsia or coma during labor. Reba DeFore didn't want to admit, even to herself, that she was more frightened by the prospect of delivering Quivel's baby than anything she had ever faced, including Okajanik's perverted swampy horde. She studied Quivel's face, the way her delicate features contorted periodically with pain or exertion, as if she were in the throes of a nightmare or trying to fight her way back to consciousness. She brushed her fingertips over a lock of silken hair curving across the forehead, and it fell away from her scalp like a loose collection of threads. DeFore set her teeth. Quivel's skin eruptions and hair loss did more than baffle her. They put her in a state of bewilderment so extreme she could barely form cogent thoughts. She did know they weren't the recorded symptoms of eclampsia. After examining Quivel many times over the past 5 months, she had determined the differences, if any, between old human and new human physiologies and biologies were too subtle to be detected. Quivel's body contained all the same organs in all the same places as a normal human female on the high side of puberty, except Quivel claimed to be nearly 68 years old. Her pregnancy had already manifested a few unusual conditions, but Quivel claimed those were connected to nutrition. As a hybrid, she required food that was easily digestible for her simplified intestinal tract. Although Lakesh had undertaken a lot of time and trouble to make sure the food lockers and meat freezers of the redoubt were exceptionally well stocked, there was very little in the way of single-cell protein microorganisms the hybrids normally ingested. Oatmeal and ice cream served as improvisations until a way to manufacture the microorganisms was perfected. DeFore utilized a synthesization process using equipment taken from the moon base. The process had so far proved successful. Therefore, Reba DeFore could only conclude that whatever was affecting Quivel, it had nothing to do with her pregnancy and had far more to do with her hybrid metabolism. Like everyone else in the redoubt, DeFore knew that the hybrid race was as intellectually superior to humankind as the Cro-Magnon was to the Australopithecus, but the hybrids paid a heavy price for their superior abilities. Compared to the old humans, they were fragile, their autoimmune systems at the mercy of infections and diseases that had little effect on the primitive apekin they ruled. Nor could they reproduce by intercourse. The nine barons were the products of in vitro fertilization, as were all hybrid offspring. Quivel's pregnancy was the unprecedented exception to the rule. Because of their susceptibility to illness, the barons were forced to live insulated, isolated existences, cloaking themselves in theatrical trappings that not only added to their semi-divine mystique, but also protected them from contamination, both psychological and physical. However, Quivel had implied there were at least three distinct classes or genotypes of hybrid, with the Barons occupying the top rung of their DNA helix. Although she hadn't come right out and stated it, she had given DeFore the distinct impression that only the Barons required the annual medical treatments, not the rank-and-file hybrid drones who served them. Despite never having seen a representative of the baronial genotype in the flesh, DeFore understood they were considerably taller than the average drone hybrid.
Will she die?
DeFore didn't need to turn around to know who had asked the question. Only Domi could have moved with enough natural stealth across the entire infirmary without making a sound. She turned around to face the small albino girl standing between two of the partitions.
I don't know, Domi. I wish I could tell you something encouraging.
A freshly scrubbed Domi had changed into one of the sedate white bodysuits, which only increased the stark contrast between her ruby eyes and piquant face.
Is it what you said before?
She's displaying the primary symptoms of its onset, but as for the eczema and hair loss, it's not eczema. I don't know what the hell it is, or have any idea of what's going on, Domi. I'm sorry.
Domi nibbled her underlip and stepped over to Quivel's bedside.
Not your fault. This ain't like anything I ever saw either.
Domi, I would imagine that because of your upbringing in an outland settlement, you've witnessed a virtual encyclopedia of medical conditions and ailments, from rat poisoning to snakebite. Have you ever helped deliver a baby?
Helped deliver them. Delivered them on my own. Held them when they took first breaths. Held them as they breathed their last. Buried them. Done it all except have my own.
Will you help me with Quivel when the time comes?
Of course I will. Quivel is my friend. So are you.
DeFore felt the sting of grateful tears in her eyes, and she blinked them back. She moved to the medical scanner.
If I could only get a half-assed idea of what's going on with her, I'd feel a lot more confident.
According to Descartes, Quivel said something terrible was happening.
That's an understatement. I just wish she'd been a little more specific.
DeFore's eyes shot to the diagnostic scanner. The flashing icons and jumping jagged lines showed Quivel's sudden surge in pulse and heart rate. She began shaking, her petite frame trembling violently. DeFore leaned over her.
She's seizing. All metabolic functions are accelerating.
Quivel's body seemed to attempt to bend at the waist. The skin on her face pulsed with a multitude of tiny bubble-like blisters that burst with every breath she dragged into her lungs. She reached up and clawed away what was left of the hair attached to her scalp. Her mouth opened as if she were about to voice a scream, but no sound came out. Her eyes stared wide, but they were empty and glazed, like milky pearls, mirroring no emotions, no thoughts. The shape of her face was distorted subtly from what DeFore had come to accept as normal for hybrids. Jaw suddenly too blunt, a hairless skull, tendons swelling bizarrely at the base of her neck, and pronounced supraorbital ridges casting her empty eyes into shadow. There was something reptilian about the cast of her features and the hooded, heavy-lidded eyes. DeFore didn't need to take her pulse rate to know it was racing. She started to push her back onto the bed, then realized Quivel was fighting her way back to consciousness through sheer force of will, like a drowning woman struggling with the sea. Domi suddenly leaned forward and struck Quivel open-handed on the right side of her face. The impact sloughed off a layer of flesh as if it had been exposed to great heat, but suddenly the gleam of intelligence, of awareness, returned to Quivel's cloudy eyes. She stared at Domi, her lips working. Then she turned to DeFore.
Cain, must speak to him. Tell him while I can, while I am still who I am. Tell him of the child. Bring Cain before it's too late.
Although no one around the table eyed him directly, Cain sensed Bridget Baptiste and Grant tensing up on either side of him. He knew they and Lakesh vividly recalled the incident when he had attempted to strangle Balaam after the entity had revealed some of the truth about the so-called Archon Directorate. Now, he managed to maintain a relatively calm facade as he gazed intently into Balaam's obsidian eyes.
Enlil is dead. So's the rest of the Pantheon, the Anunnaki royal family. We saw what was left of them in their burial catacombs under the moon. Remember, Bridget?
Even if I could forget something, I'm not liable to forget much of that experience.
Everything Bridget read or saw or even heard was impressed indelibly on her mind. Although Cain often accused her of using her encyclopedic memory to make herself appear far more knowledgeable than she actually was, she viewed her ability as a valuable resource that had nothing to do with ego.
Enlil's body is dead, but the signature of his mind energy, as well as his genetic imprint, lived on, as did those of the Supreme Council of Overlords.
How?
Long before Enlil entered cryostasis, his entire biological blueprint was encoded and downloaded into a tablet of destiny.
Oh, what?
According to Sumerian myth, there were allegedly 7 tablets of destiny. They contained the Anunnaki's ultimate plan for the universe.
To be precise, there are 9 tablets. 9 tablets for 9 overlords.
That doesn't explain anything. You're talking in riddles and circles.
Get used to it with him.
Balaam regarded him with a blank expression that nevertheless seemed to convey reproach. He crooked a finger toward Erica Van Sloan.
Now is the time to relate what you witnessed within the Pyramid of Shan only a short time ago.
I'll try. But I still feel like I'm in a state of shock. It was a nerve-shattering experience for me.
Oh, give us a break, Twee Twee John. Your idea of a real nerve-shattering experience is to bump into somebody who doesn't drop to their knees and beg to kiss your ass.
Erica swung a baleful glare in Bridget's direction. Bridget rarely lapsed into vernacular or vulgarity. Her comment showed only a minuscule amount of the deep contempt she felt for the woman. Like Lakesh and a handful of other pre-darkers, Erica Van Sloan had been revived from cryostasis when the program of unification reached a certain stage of progress. A brilliant cyberneticist, she had been chosen to act as an advisor due to her success in developing and perfecting the SQUID implants, the superconducting quantum interface devices. Although Erica had not actually invented the SQUIDs, she refined them to a new level of sophistication and used them as the foundation of the first fully functioning large-scale mind-machine interface. Since the main difficulty in constructing interfaces between mechanical, electric, and organic systems was the wiring, Erica herself oversaw the implantation of SQUIDs directly into the subject's brain. They were only 1/100th of a micron across and drew power from the electromagnetic field generated by the neuronic energy of the brain itself. Everyone who was aware of her scientific background knew the Imperial trooper standing at the door was more than likely influenced by a SQUID. Also, like Lakesh, Erica Van Sloan owed her apparent youth and vibrancy to the Imperator. Months before, upon their initial meeting, Sam had restored Lakesh's physical condition to that of a man in his mid-40s by what at the time seemed to be a miraculous laying on of hands. At the time, Lakesh's eyes had been covered by thick lenses and a hearing aid inserted into one ear. What he most resembled was a hunched-over, spindly old scarecrow who appeared to be fighting the grave for every hour he remained on the planet. At the time, Sam claimed he had increased Lakesh's production of 2 antioxidant enzymes, catalase and superoxide dismutase, and boosted his alkyglycerol level to the point where the aging process was, for all intents and purposes, reversed. Sam had indeed accomplished all of that, but only recently did Lakesh learn the precise methodology. When he laid his hands on Lakesh, he had injected nanomachines into his body. The nanites were programmed to recognize and destroy the dangerous replicators, whether they were bacteria, cancer cells, or viruses. Sam's nanites performed selective destruction on the genes of DNA cells, removing the part that caused aging. To her dismay, Erica Van Sloan had discovered that she was equally dependent on Sam for her own restored youth and vitality.
"Do go on, Erica."
Her violet eyes glinting hard, the woman began speaking, telling of the bizarre metamorphosis she had witnessed among Barons Beausoleil and Cobalt, and with Sam. Grant's jaw muscles knotted at the mention of Beausoleil, but he said nothing.
"Cobalt, so the Imperator offered him sanctuary? Or was it a prison?"
"I never found out, and I doubt I ever will. I assume what I just told you means the same thing to you as it does to me. The kings are returning to their kingdom."
Her conclusion stunned conversation for a few seconds, but to Cain it felt like a chain of eternities. As if from a great distance, he heard himself talking.
"The hybrid barons are changing into Anunnaki overlords. The ship called Tiamat has somehow awakened a dormant part of their minds.
And their genes.
They're regaining their former personalities, their identities, even their memories."
"Yes. You might view the Barons as a larval or chrysalis stage of their development. Did you never wonder why the end result of the hybridization program seemed so fragile, so rife with biological defects, so sensitive to autoimmune diseases?
I sure as hell did. When I was first told about the whole baronial setup, I thought it seemed pretty strange. Just like I wonder why any of us sitting here, except for you and the dragon lady, should believe this bullshit.
I happen to believe him, Dr. Philboyd. I understand how mad all this must seem to you, but to the rest of us here, myself at any rate, it makes perfect sense. At long last.
Oh, come on. You told me these barons were a minimum of 90 years old? How can any organism exist at an intermediate stage for so damn long?
In nature, there is the axolotl salamander. It's an amphibian, but it exhibits the phenomenon known as neoteny. Ordinarily, amphibians undergo metamorphosis from egg to larva and finally to adult form. The axolotl, along with a number of other amphibians, remains in its larval form its entire life, meaning that it retains its gills and the fins of a fish, even reaches sexual maturity in the larval stage.
Bridget, the axolotl is a salamander. I'm talking about...
Exactly. You don't know what you're talking about.
I thought the general consensus of opinion was that Sam was another version of this Colonel Thrush, not some moldy old Sumerian god.
Sam's true identity is still a matter of speculation.
Testimony had indicated that the mind of Sam was actually a receptacle for the mind of the loathsome Colonel C.W. Thrush. However, even if Sam served as the living storage vessel for the Thrush program, apparently he hadn't fully downloaded all the algorithmic data and realized his true identity. Quavell had been the one to theorize that the complete Thrush entity ID was suspended in a kind of memory buffer, with the identity compressed and not fully downloaded.
It's not a matter of speculation anymore. Thrush was Sam, and Sam was Samyaza, who was really Enlil, and Enlil was always Thrush, and now he's Enlil again.
Oh, shut up.
Cain ignored the sudden blaze of autocratic rage in the woman's eyes. A fragment of a memory ghosted through his mind concerning his final encounter with a version of Thrush on the third Lost Earth. Thrush admitted that his creators had used Anunnaki neural pathways as a template for his operating system.
If any of this is true, it took a hell of a lot of planning over a hell of a long time. Who was the mastermind?
Enlil and the Supreme Council of Overlords. They drafted the plan.
When?
I cannot provide you an exact date, but I would be safe in stating it was at least 4,000 years ago, after the final battle in the war between the Anunnaki, the Tuatha De Danann, and the First Folk.
When the long conflict between the Danann and the Anunnaki drew to a close, the major component of the peace agreement was that both races would adopt a hands-off policy toward humanity. But in order to monitor their cultural and technological development, the two races mingled their genetic material with a blend of superior human DNA to create a custodial race. The First Folk, they were called. It was their duty to keep the ancient secrets of their ancestors alive, yet not propagate the same errors as their forebears, especially in their dealings with man, to whom they were inextricably bound. Humankind was still struggling to overcome a global cataclysm, striving again for civilization, and the graceful First Folk did what they could to help them rebuild. They insinuated themselves into schools, into political circles, prompting and assisting men into making the right decisions. Due to the First Folk's influence, Earth cultures enjoyed 1,000 years of relative peace and harmony, during which the Atlantean civilization arose. Lam, a leader of the folk and Balaam's father, sought to convince the Anunnaki and Danann representatives to allow humanity to grow and evolve without strictures. Instead, the two races threatened to visit another cataclysm upon Earth and hurl humankind back into savagery. The First Folk knew their forebears had too many weapons in their arsenals, stolen and adapted from other worlds they visited and exploited, for them to be able to defend Earth. Nor did they possess the resources to fight an all-out war. But once they had aroused their forebears' suspicions, they had no choice but to take quick, preemptive action. They employed an energy called protoplanic force, which demolished an Anunnaki settlement on the moon and killed the royal family. There was a blowback effect, a reverse reaction that the First Folk hadn't foreseen. It nearly destroyed the Earth and decimated human and First Folk civilizations. In their attempts to defend humankind, they had inadvertently brought about the destruction their forebears had threatened. After the global catastrophe, the First Folk transformed themselves to adapt to the new environment. Their muscle tissue became less dense, motor reflexes sharpened, optic capacities broadened. A new range of psychic abilities was developed, which allowed them to survive on a planet whose magnetic fields had changed, whose weather was drastically unpredictable. In the process, the physical appearance of Balaam's kind changed from tall, slender, graceful creatures to small, furtive shadow dwellers. Although the survivors of the First Folk were viewed by humans as demons and monsters, they still tried to protect the human race over the long track of time as they clawed their way back up from barbarism. At the dawn of Earth's Industrial Revolution, the First Folk's descendants, the entities later known as Greys and Archons, feared more reprisals from their forebears. They embarked on a series of raids against the Anunnaki and Danann outposts still extant on the solar planets. The Martian base was devastated, but the remnants of the Tuatha De Danann civilization remained, known as the Monuments of Mars, like the Great Stone Face and the Pyramid City. A ferocious scowl had inscribed deep lines on Grant's forehead.
I don't understand. If they came up with this scheme 4,000 years ago, how the hell could they have kept any part of it going after they died?
I helped keep it going, Grant. I helped implement the final stages of the plan, which included aspects of the totality concept, the program of unification, and the rule of the Barons. I had no choice. It was a debt my people owed to the root race, and as the last of my kind, it was my portion, my duty, to see it through to completion, to restore to life that which the actions of my forebears had caused to die.
What the hell do you mean by that? Your people damn near destroyed the moon and the earth trying to get rid of the Anunnaki and then started feeling guilty about it?
Not I. I feel no guilt whatsoever regarding the fate that befell the few Anunnaki who remained on this world and Luna. It was a time of war, and despite their pious pronouncements to the contrary, the Anunnaki were ever at war until the actions of my people ended their ability to wage it, even among themselves.
Brigid, Lakesh, Kane, and Grant had learned how two factions of the Anunnaki fought each other over the course of humanity's future. Enlil, who commanded lordship over the Earth, wanted humankind to be kept in as primitive a state as possible. The opposing group, led by his half-brother Enki, disagreed with this stance. The ruling council of the Anunnaki delayed making a decision and decreed that they needed intermediaries between themselves and the masses of humanity. They chose ancient Mesopotamia to conduct this experiment in social engineering and religion building. A hierarchy was clearly defined, and for many millennia, the Anunnaki oversaw the welfare and fate of humankind. All the while, they remained apart from the people, approachable only by the high priests and kings on specified dates, communicating only with their plenipotentiaries. At some point, a rivalry arose between opposing factions of the Anunnaki for the hearts and minds of the people. Partly because they had come to depend increasingly on human kings and their armies to achieve their ends. When this situation became too unwieldy, the Anunnaki chose to create a new dynasty of rulers, known as demigods or god-kings because of their exalted bloodlines. As a bridge between themselves, a pantheon of gods, and humankind, they introduced the concept of the god-king on Earth. They appointed human rulers who would assure humankind's service to the deities and channel their teachings and laws to the people. Sumerian texts described how, although the Anunnaki retained lordship over the lands and humankind was viewed as little more than a tenant farmer, humanity grew arrogant. Fearing a unified human race, both in culture and purpose, the Anunnaki adopted the imperial policy of divide and rule. For while humankind reached higher cultural levels and the populations expanded, the Anunnaki themselves fell into decline. Anu, the leader of the Anunnaki, returned to Nibiru after arranging a division of powers and territories on Earth between his feuding sons, Enlil and Enki. Civilizations were created by the two half-brothers, such as Egypt, Sumer, and India. Wars were fought by the families of Enki and Enlil, and the nations changed hands back and forth through different conflicts. After one such war, following the declaration of an uneasy peace, Enlil tried to force his brethren to make a decision about what to do about humanity. As humankind procreated and their numbers increased, while those of the Anunnaki lessened, Enlil grew fearful and prevailed upon the Supreme Council to allow a deluge to wipe humanity off the face of the earth. But Enki was not happy about the decision to commit genocide and sought ways to frustrate the plan. He managed to do so to a point, but his efforts were immortalized as the story of Noah and the Ark.
Why would you have anything to do with a plan that would ensure the return of the Anunnaki overlords? Unless you have plans of your own to further, which wouldn't be the first time you've used a smokescreen and diversions to hide your true intentions and get what you wanted.
What was needed? And you are correct in your assessment that I do indeed have plans of my own, but they do not benefit Enlil or the overlords.
Explain.
Through the years, over the centuries, Enlil's neural pathways took many names, adopted many vessels, even as his original physical form lay in stasis. As you know, as Colonel C.W. Thrush, he acted as an emissary of my people.
Right. Your go-to guy, Colonel Thrush, a blending of machine, human, and Anunnaki. The one who cut your people's dirty deals with all the maniacs in human history.
There were far too many turbulent periods in history when humanity savagely persecuted witches, demons, and other creatures your psychotic fears perceived as real. My folk would have been killed outright, not viewed as ambassadors or cousins of humankind. Enlil, in the guise of Thrush, could move easily through the oppressive times of warfare and mass murder. He manipulated chaotic events to best fit his agenda. The world that emerged from the nuclear holocaust of 2 centuries ago fits the Naburian model.
What? It's a world of barbarism, of ignorance, of torture, of the institution of murder to meet selfish ends. That doesn't seem like a place an advanced race of pseudo-gods would want to make their home.
That's because you forget one thing. Earth is their home. The Anunnaki lived here long before modern man. They've just been away while it was being remodeled and fumigated. Am I right, Balam?
In one sense. You didn't mention the atmospheric and geological changes, as well as the extreme depopulation that the overlords will no doubt find congenial.
Assuming you're speaking the truth, what will the reborn or reincarnated overlords be doing?
Reclaiming the nations and regions of the Earth they ruled millennia ago.
There are only 8 overlords. Baron Ragnar is dead, and he had no successor. And even if the overlords were at a full complement of 9, they could barely control their own baronial territories, much less the entire damn world.
Balam gazed at him silently, speculatively. Then the index finger of his right hand uncurled and pointed straight up. Grant reflexively glanced toward the ceiling before the meaning of the gesture occurred to him.
Tiamat?
Tiamat. A warship that could easily lay waste to the entire surface of Earth in less than a month. And do not confuse the Barons as you knew them with the Overlords. The differences are quite dramatic, I assure you.
Would they do such a thing?
If they perceived sufficient resistance to their rule to justify it. Enlil certainly had no qualms about devastating large portions of the Earth and its inhabitants thousands of years ago. He would have less restraint now without Enki to act as a mitigating influence on his behavior.
Far from resistance to their rule, I know from experience in this and the pre-dark world that a population faced with destruction will seek any form of salvation that is offered to them.
Enlil knows how to offer that, judging by his historical track record as a god, a demon, and as Thrush.
Wouldst thou protect us from the savageries of Satan?
Yeah. But who will be protecting us from the Protector?
Cain drummed his fingers absently on the tabletop.
There's obviously something we can do about this. Otherwise, Balam would have left us swinging in the wind until Tiamat floated down to blow us off the mountain. Am I right, B?
Balam's slit of a mouth twitched in almost imperceptible imitation of a smile.
You are correct, Cain. Although the Barons are even now evolving into the Overlords, regaining their full faculties will require some little time. And afterward, Enlil will no doubt convene a council. The first time they have met in thousands of years. Their first order of business will be to recover the original Tablets of Destiny.
Where will they meet? Front Royal? If so, we can take the Mantas and do a little laying waste ourselves.
The Overlords will abandon the Vills and all their former baronial trappings, casting them off as a butterfly sheds its cocoon, as a...
Snake sheds its skin. Yeah, right. Lay off the similes. Do you really expect us to believe the Barons will give up all their power and surrender their Vills just because they've contracted what amounts to a skin condition?
I thought I made myself clear, Kane. I know you are not that obtuse. They are Barons no longer. They have evolved into their true forms, creatures infinitely more cunning and dangerous than the delicate egomaniacs who ruled from the safe remove of their towers in the Vills. They will not surrender their Vills, their territories. They have no need to. They will simply turn their backs on them and move on to the next phase of their lives. To promote and prosecute their agenda to remake Earth into a new Nibiru.
That's insane! With the Barons gone, the Vills will fall apart.
Anarchy. The antithesis of the program of unification. God only knows what will happen once word gets out that the Barons have abandoned the Vills. Riots, revolts, massacres.
Bridget Grant and Kane all exchanged stricken looks. The three of them were Vill-bred, and despite their efforts to overthrow the hybrid despots, the notion of the network of fortress cities functioning without the intimidating presence of the Barons unnerved them. Because of their lifetime of conditioning, the concept was almost inconceivable. They struggled to come to terms with the full implications of everything Balaam had imparted. Trying to comprehend the mind-numbing maneuvers and countermaneuvers undertaken by Enlil as he moved his chess pieces over a vast board of power plays that stretched across the world and millennia was a migraine-inducing exercise.
Well, we wanted to topple the Barons anyway, but I didn't picture it happening like this.
Neither did the Barons until Tiamat arrived.
But you pictured it. You were the only one who could have. Almost 100 years ago, you showed up with Thrush, Enlil, during the first council of the Barons to convince them to cooperate with the program of unification. What happened to that version of Thrush?
I do not know, Kane.
Although Balaam's expression reflected nothing, Kane received the impression he was made uncomfortable by the question, either because he didn't have the answer, or because he did.
Despite what you may think, I am not omnipotent.
I never thought you were. Just a sneaky, tricky, big-headed little bastard who only tells the truth when my hands are around your throat. Even so, you created a new body for Thrush. You downloaded an identity program into it and called him Sam this time. You installed him in power as the Imperator.
How little you understand.
We understand enough. You could have stopped all this at any time, but you let the scenario play out. Now, when it's too late, you come to us. Why? To tell us oops, or to ask our forgiveness?
Balaam gazed unblinkingly and unperturbed at the faces around the table.
Hardly either one, Grant. Did you not understand when I explained that Tiamat was waiting to return at this preordained time? She would have done so regardless of any action I took to interfere with Enlil's plan.
Yes, but if Sam was the key to the rebirth of the Overlords all along, then you could have done something to keep him from growing into the role.
Perhaps I could have prevented Sam from emerging from the cloning vats or altered the programming of the nanomachines on which his metabolism depended.
Or you could have just pushed the arrogant son of a bitch off the top of his pyramid.
And if I had, what would I have accomplished?
For one thing, there wouldn't have been a DNA control for Tiamat to interface with.
Balaam nodded as if Grant were a slow student and had finally reasoned out a relatively simple math problem.
Exactly.
But Tiamat would have come back anyway, right? And if she couldn't make contact with Enlil's EEG signature or genetic imprint, or if they didn't match up with the records in her database.
In that eventuality, her programming is clear and unalterable and inviolate. To destroy this planet, to render it utterly lifeless. That is what would have happened if I had embarked on any of the courses of action you suggested.
She is capable of all that.
And much more. She can dispatch remote probes, essentially smaller versions of herself, to blanket the planet with fusion bombs, biological and chemical weapons, and defoliants of all kinds. The seas would be poisoned, the atmosphere contaminated, starvation and exposure to radiation would kill anyone who was unlucky enough to survive the initial onslaughts. Humanity as the dominant species on this world will cease to exist. I had hoped that over the last 3,000 plus years, Tiamat's systems might have suffered malfunctions, or she might have been damaged by meteor collisions. Unfortunately, the Anunnaki built her too well, as they built all of their machines and weapons, many of which still exist in vaults here on Earth, just waiting for the overlords to remember them and reclaim them.
That's just great. Thanks bunches, Balam. You saved the world by refusing to do anything to stop the reincarnated Anunnaki from taking over. We'll have a medal pinning ceremony as soon as I can find one with a picture of a snake screwing a human on it.
There's lots of military memorabilia down in one of the storage bays. Uniforms, flags...
Shut up, Brewster! All right, so rather than dealing with a giant Anunnaki spaceship, we'll be dealing with the Anunnaki Supreme Council instead. Minus one.
Actually, the lack of one member is only temporary. The full complement of nine, under the command of Enlil, will soon be restored.
How soon?
As soon as Quavel gives birth. Did you not wonder why Sam set you the task of capturing her?
Cain felt a jolt of fear at Balaam's calm pronouncement, but he managed to refrain from profanely demanding a clarification.
Of course I did. But he charged me with many tasks, from assuming command of Cobaltville to recruiting Lakesh to our cause. The apprehension of Quavel was just one more assignment.
Just one more you failed to accomplish, you mean?
Erica Van Sloan's spine stiffened in barely repressed rage, but Bridget turned her penetrating emerald gaze on Balaam.
Explain.
That is not within my purview, but an explanation will be forthcoming very soon.
Cain, I don't care where you are or what you're doing, but Quavel needs you in the infirmary. Not ASAP, not stat, right now!
Behind her occluded, pearl-colored eyes, Cain could see very little of the Quavel he had known in Cerberus, and even less of the woman who had acted as the leader of an underground resistance movement in Area 51. Clenching his teeth tight on a cry of horror and revulsion, Cain forced himself to gaze at Quavel without recoiling. There was almost nothing recognizable about the blunt-jawed face above the tendon-wrapped neck. The nose barely qualified as a flare-nostriled nub, and the lipless slit of a mouth gaped slightly open. A gown covered her gaunt figure, but her arms were bare. The patches of flesh that remained on them hung in tatters like ragged old cloth. The texture of the epidermis beneath suggested a pattern of moist, gray-green, pebbled scales. Her eyes, beneath a jutting overhang of brow, stared unwinking, luminously at Cain, without a hint of emotion, human or otherwise.
Cain!
Quavel thrust out her hairless head on an inhumanly long neck in a disquietingly serpentine fashion. Repressing a shudder, Cain forced himself not to step back through the partition when she reached for him with long, knob-knuckled and claw-tipped fingers. He took her hand in his, dismayed by how cold it felt to the touch.
I'm here, Quavel.
Her peeling lips worked and writhed as she struggled to speak.
Losing my ability to think clearly. Another will is imposing itself over my own. Too powerful to resist much longer. But I must tell you...
Her fingers tightened on Cain's hand with a surprisingly painful grip.
What's happening to her?
She's changing into an overlord. An Anunnaki.
You are mistaken, Cain.
Cain glanced over his shoulder as Balaam pushed aside the partition. Defoe's eyes shot wide open in wordless fear, while Domi's hand made a reflexive grab for the gun not holstered at her hip. If Quavel experienced a similar reaction, her face didn't register it.
You both remember my old buddy Balaam. He and Erica Van Sloan gated in here about half an hour ago. I asked him to come here with me because he knows what's going on with Quavel.
How about sharing it with me, goddammit? Maybe then I can treat her.
I fear that will not be possible.
Balaam spoke to the women quickly, employing straightforward, unadorned language. When he was done, both Defore and Domi gaped at him in astonishment.
Cain, do you believe him?
I have no reason not to. Quavel is suffering from the same ailment as the Barons, and all of the hybrids, I guess.
Once again, you are mistaken. Only a select genotype is changing. The Quad Vs.
They're not turning into Anunnaki?
They are not. The Quad Vs were bred as a high-ranking servant class, what you might refer to as majordomos.
Lakesh might refer to them that way. I don't think anyone else here would.
The Quad Vs possess a higher percentage of human DNA than the Barons. That is why they didn't require the strict annual regimen of medical treatments to stabilize their body chemistry.
Then why is she changing?
She is not changing into an overlord, but into one of the Nephilim. They are the servants of the overlords, the foot soldiers, the warriors, and the legendary armies of darkness who play such a role in human parables.
He speaks the truth. Unfamiliar imagery is filling my mind. New thoughts, even new languages.
Cain felt a great fear welling up within him, but he tamped it down.
What about the baby?
The Nephilim were also used as breeding stock by the overlords. The child she carries will be absorbed into the Pantheon and will assume the identity of one of them, providing the neural pathways can be successfully downloaded from a tablet of destiny.
Not my child.
Cain!
Cain returned his attention to Quavel. Despite the whitish lenses that had grown over her eyes, he sensed she stared at him imploringly.
Not your child, Cain!
That's what I said.
No! The baby is not yours.
What?
Quavel shook her head, reaching out to grasp his wrist with her other hand.
We did not conceive the baby together, Cain. You are not the father.
But we... What about all the times we...
Difficult to explain. Hard to put thoughts into words.
Balaam stepped close to Quavel, extending a hand toward her, fingers stretched out straight.
Allow me.
Quavel leaned forward, bowing her head in a posture almost of reverence. Balaam placed the tips of his fingers on her forehead, just above the bridge of her nose. Cain knew Balaam was anchored to the hybrids through some filaments of their mind energy, akin to the hive mind of certain insect species. A couple of years before, when Baron Ragnar was assassinated, Balaam had experienced an extreme reaction to the sudden absence of the Baron's mind filament. Inasmuch as all of the Archon genetic material in the hybrids had derived from Balaam, that connection wasn't particularly surprising. They had learned that the DNA of Balaam's folk was infinitely adaptable, malleable, its segments able to achieve a near seamless sequencing pattern with whatever biological material was spliced to it. In some ways, it acted like a virus, overwriting other genetic codes, picking and choosing the best human qualities to enhance. Their DNA could be tinkered with to create endless variations, as well as adjusted and fine-tuned. Within seconds, Balaam removed his hand from Quavel's forehead and regarded Cain dispassionately.
Quavel was the only female of the Quad V genotype who survived the destruction of the Archuleta Mesa installation. Therefore, she was the only one of that genotype who participated in Baron Cobalt's experiment. Unlike the other females, she volunteered for the seeding sessions.
What do you mean she volunteered?
Wanted.
You wanted a baby, but not Cain's baby?
Quavel nodded.
She wanted to conceive a child with a man with whom she had fallen in love. A man named Madoc.
Cain's memory flew back to his period of imprisonment in the vast Dreamland facility, putting a face to the name of the young man. Quavel had arranged for his escape from his holding cell and introduced him to the fifth column of humans and hybrids working secretly against Baron Cobalt. He remembered Quavel explaining how the survivors of the Archuleta Mesa disaster reached the conclusion that only mutual genocide lay in the future if changes, both philosophical and practical, were not implemented. When Cain asked what kind of changes she referred to, Maddock had spoken of a new, redefined program of unification, one where they shared what was left of the planet's resources with each other, instead of dividing it up between the conquered and the conquerors.
If I'm not the baby's father, then why did you leave Maddock and Area 51 to come here?
Keep safe.
She put one hand protectively on her belly.
To keep the baby safe? I thought the whole point of Baron Cobalt's plan was for you to give birth to a baby fathered by a human male, if for nothing else but to prove the hybrid females themselves could provide a new supply of genetic material for the Baron's annual treatments.
Baby supposed to be fathered by Cain? Not Maddock? That was Baron's plan.
If you had intercourse with both Cain and Maddock, how can you be so sure who the father is?
As a Quad V, Quavel can exert a certain amount of control over her metabolism. Cain, she did not wish to be impregnated by you. Therefore, she was not. Conversely, she very much wanted to conceive a child by Maddock, but she could not allow herself to be made pregnant by him before the seeding sessions with you were complete.
Realization rushed through Cain like a flow of cold water circulating through his veins. He gazed intently at Quavel's distorted face.
You participated in the Baron's program as a form of protective coloration, since a relationship with Maddock would have never been sanctioned. After I escaped, you conceived with Maddock, counting on everyone to assume that I was the father.
She ducked her head in a jerky nod, but did not speak.
However, after Baron Cobalt was displaced from his authority over Area 51 and a consortium of barons assumed control, Quavel feared for the safety of the fetus. The other barons didn't share Cobalt's interest in the breeding program. She began to fear that medical testing would prove the fetus was not yours, Cain, but Maddock's, since both of your DNA records were on file. Therefore, to protect both the baby and Maddock, she fled.
A confusing riot of emotions cascaded through Cain. Simultaneously, he experienced relief, sadness, shame, and even a bit of anger. However, he fought to keep his face and voice calm.
Quavel, it might be difficult to do so, but we could try to spirit Maddock out of Dreamland and bring him here. If Balaam is to be believed, there won't be any barons watching the place.
No, Maddock is dead.
When? How do you know?
Baron Beausoleil told me she killed him months ago now.
Anger sent a sudden flush of heat to the back of Cain's neck and caused the blood to pound in his temples. Grant was still recovering from the injuries he received after being captured and tortured by the sadistic Baron Beausoleil only a short time before.
She boasted about killing him. She told me that true first love was like an addictive drug. And like drug addiction, a true first love always has tragic consequences.
You should have told us about this.
I'll make her pay, Quavel. If I've done nothing else for you, I'll by God do that.
Quavel closed her eyes and tears inched from the corners.
I do not want revenge. I want only your forgiveness.
My forgiveness? For what?
For duping you, manipulating you, and everyone here into protecting me, offering me sanctuary when I knew all along the baby was not yours. You undertook many risks for me under false assumptions. I am sorry.
Even if we had known, we wouldn't have acted any differently.
You helped me. Hid me in Area 51. You're my friend. Besides, it's been fun having you here. We'll have even more fun when the baby is born.
Thank you.
Quavel's flesh suddenly pulsed and throbbed in a way Cain knew was neither human nor hybrid. Releasing Kane's hand, she clutched the small figurine attached to the chain around her neck.
The next few hours are critical. Under the circumstances, I'm going to act as though her labor is high risk. I'm asking you now, Balam, and I expect a straight goddamn answer. Will it be?
I honestly do not know. Certainly, Quavel's metabolic functions and processes are changing as her dormant gene combinations become active.
What that do for the baby?
These are unprecedented events, and I cannot answer your questions. I have no prior data that might help me to formulate even a hypothesis.
Yeah, what do you think he is? Omnipotent or something?
He sure as hell acted like it when he was a prisoner here. Right now, I want both of you out. Just stand by in case you're needed.
What do you expect me to do?
I don't know. That's why I want you to stand by.
Balam and Kane walked out between the partitions into the infirmary proper. Several people, most of them Manetius emigres, were clustered around the doorway. When they caught sight of Balam, they hastily withdrew into the corridor.
My presence has attracted an undue amount of curiosity.
Yeah, well, they don't get out much.
Kane?
What?
You cannot stand by as Dr. Defoe requested. There are far weightier matters for us to attend to.
Such as?
I know where Enlil will most likely meet with the Overlords. It is very possible that this will be the only time all of them will be together in one confined area. Their first order of business will be to retrieve the Tablets of Destiny. Without them, they can exert no control over Tiamat.
So they'll be working together? They'll put aside their disagreements?
Less than a year before, the Nine Baronies had been poised on the brink of civil war, sparked by one of their own, Baron Cobalt. Although full-scale hostilities involving all the barons had been averted, the doctrine of unity by which the Nine Vils were formed had been decisively shattered.
Territorial disputes among the barons mean less than nothing to the overlords. We must make plans, mount a mission to strike peremptorily and decisively.
What's with this we business? I thought working as a behind-the-scenes puppet master was your stock in trade, the invisible string puller.
Balam conveyed the attitude of someone who had been insulted but was too dignified to show he was offended by Kane's oblique reference to his people's operating methods. Historically, they made alliances with certain individuals or governments who in turn reaped the benefits of power and wealth. Following this pattern, the Archons made their advanced technology available to the American military in order to fully develop the totality concept. It was the use of that technology, without a full understanding of it, that contributed to the events that led to the nuclear holocaust of 2001.
True, I do not enjoy endangering myself. I have awaited and dreaded this day in a life that has not been brief. But just as I am not omnipotent, I am not immortal. However, if I do not accompany you and your friends, the mission will fail.
Accompany me and my friends where?
The region of Earth once known as Mesopotamia. On your modern maps, it is called Iraq.
In the hours after sunset, the endless vista of indigo sky spread out above the holy city of Nippur like the unfurling of a sail. The sky was so heavy with haze, only a few stars glittered. A dim light fell from the cloud-covered face of the moon, its pallid glow silvering the dark surface of the Euphrates. No whisper of wind came off the river or gusted over the reed marshes along it. Nippur was built on a spur of land that jutted out to bisect the flowing headwaters. The rocky peninsula rose in a flat rampart toward its center, and from it loomed a broad-based, brooding mass of terraced stone and heat-glazed clay. Ekur, the holy ziggurat of Enlil, towered above the ruins of ancient buildings and fields of windswept sand like the god it had been constructed to honor. A few stumps of the old towers still stood, surrounded by broken walls and heaps of wind-driven sand. Rasura stood at the opening of a long flagstone ceremonial promenade. Lined on either side by square, squat columns, inestimable centuries of weather had pitted and scarred the bas-reliefs so they were barely visible. The double-facing row of pillars led to the foot of the vast ziggurat. As his gaze followed their lines, the high priest felt keen despair, as he did more often each day. Despite all the decades of toil, all the personal loss he and his fellow priests had suffered in their lifelong effort to rebuild the city, Nippur was still a distorted shadow, a rough sketch of what it had once been. Here, many thousands of years earlier, Enlil had breathed life into the clay taken from the banks of the Euphrates and brought forth the first man. There, kneeling on the sprit of land dividing the watercourse of the river, Abraham had prayed for guidance. Rasura knew the ancient history of the city far better than he knew the backgrounds and life experiences of the two priests who labored along behind him. Nippur had been built as a sacred city, not as a political capital. Still, it played an all-important role in the politics of the region, which had encompassed Sumeria, Assyria, Babylonia, and numerous city-states. To the south lay Ur, to the north lay Akkad, and the city was open to the people from both areas, functioning as an arbiter in disputes between these potential enemies. Upon ascending the throne in cities such as Kish, Ur, and Isin, rulers sought recognition at Ekur, within the shrine of Enlil, the dais of abundance, the tabernacle of the starfire. In return for legitimization of their claims to the throne, the kings lavished gifts of land, precious metals, and stones and other commodities on the temples and on the city as a whole. At the end of successful wars, rulers presented plunder, including captives, to Enlil and the other gods who might be present at Nippur. Even over 2,000 years ago, when the Babylonians made Marduk the most important god in southern Mesopotamia, Enlil was still revered. Kings continued to seek support at Nippur, and the city remained the recipient of generous donations. There had been no donations to maintain the city, generous or otherwise, in many centuries. Rasura and his two fellow priests had devoted their lives to rebuilding Nippur and Ekur, as had many generations of male ancestors before them. And now they were bent by age, their health uncertain, their vision weak. Long ago they were widowed and one by one abandoned by their children who didn't share their zeal. The only reward for lifetimes of virtue had been soul-killing toil. Restoring the ziggurat alone had required nearly 80 years of unremitting back-breaking labor, spread out over three generations of four different families. The facade was made from glazed brick. A flight of new steps had been added to the square base, stretching up to join the spiral ramp. All the vertical walls sloped inward, and all horizontal lines were slightly convex in order to make it easier to plant trees and shrubs on the lower terraces. The priest caste was taught that the ziggurat had been built as a bridge between heaven and earth, so the levels nearest the ground would symbolize the elements of the world. At the height of Nippur's power and influence, priests, priestesses, musicians, singers, castrates, and hierodules staffed the ziggurat of Ekur. Public rituals, food sacrifices, and libations took place there on a daily basis. There were monthly feasts and annual New Year celebrations. But more than those secular functions, Ekur served as a cosmic axis, a vertical bond between heaven and earth and the underworld, forming a horizontal bond between the lands. Built on seven levels, with each level smaller than the preceding, the architecture represented seven heavens and planes of existence. The priesthood of Enlil knew the spiral represented the movement of consciousness from level to level, but Rasura experienced only futility when he gazed at it. All of the buildings and lesser temples scattered about the base of the ziggurat were built of solid stone, constructed in accordance with the ancient designs of sacred geometry. They fit the traditional style of architecture copied exactly from the older buildings that had stood on the site thousands of years before. But all of them were empty, housing only shadows and the lost dreams of forgotten gods. Enlil was the lord of the airspace, the dispenser of kingship, chief of the assembly of the gods and granter of agriculture. But his worshippers were few. As far as Rasura knew, he and his two brother priests were all that remained of the religion founded in his name, and they were definitely the only inhabitants of the city dedicated to him. Rasura knew when the gods met for assembly on earth, they met at Enlil's shrine within the ziggurat, where they bathed in the glory of the starfire. From there, Enlil made sure that the decrees issued by the Supreme Council of the Gods were carried out. Enlil also selected the kings who were to rule over humankind not as sovereigns, but as servants to the gods, in accordance with the laws inscribed on the Tablets of Destiny. For many years, Resura's family had excavated the ancient temples, resurrecting them from the sand, searching for the sacred Tablets of Destiny, which the Holy Codices claimed had been hidden in Nippur. He had long suspected they were safe somewhere inside Ekur, probably in the shrine. He looked up along the curving ramp of the ziggurat to where it ended in a blunt, weathered break, three-quarters of the way up. Resura nodded to Amner and Gudea, indicating it was time for the evening devotions and the ritual walk to the Eye of Enlil. Like him, they were old and gaunt, grizzled beards, matting faces the color and texture of cured rawhide. Although all three men were of different ages, Gudea being the youngest at 72 winters, all of them looked as if they had been cooked by the sun and worn down by physical labor until only bone, muscle, and stringy sinew were left. They wore loose, threadbare robes of gray, girded at the waist by braided belts. From pouches at their hips, they removed their holy faces, dull, yellow leather masks that covered the top and sides of their heads. On the forehead was a winged serpent symbol worked in dark thread. Even after all these years, Resura wasn't certain of the purpose of the masks, except to hide their shameful human visages from the haughty eyes of Enlil. The three men began a shuffling walk on sandaled feet down the center of the colonnade, Resura in the lead, Amner and Gudea following in single file, hands on one another's shoulders. Gudea lit the ceremonial braziers as they passed, symbolizing the starfire. The fragrant smoke of frankincense curled into the dry air. The pillars grouped around an open circle at the foot of the ziggurat staircase. Before the first step, an elaborate mosaic of colored tiles lay, twisting in a sacred spiral. They began chanting, a repetitive murmur in the ancient tongue of their fathers. Only the priest caste knew these words, for they were so old they could not be translated into any of the tongues that later came to dominance in the region. Before votaries could mount the stair, they were instructed to walk the spiral, working their way toward its center, following the path to its dragon core. Because their forefathers, the ancient Sumerians, knew humankind was created from the flesh of the elder gods and from the spirit of the undying, dead, but ever-dreaming Tiamat, the priests knew they shared the blood of the Nibiru. The three priests kept a fragment of prayer ever at the tips of their tongues. The borders of Nibiru form a great net, within which the eagle spreads wide its talons. The evil or wicked man does not escape its spiraling grasp. The spiral symbolized the labyrinth, the maze of life and death, the departure from the womb and the return to it, coiling into the center and returning upon itself, terminating in a pool-like mirror at its center. The mirror represented the Eye of Enlil, the Eye of Wisdom, ever judgmental, ever watchful of the proper time to return and reclaim his world. Resura's father and grandfather believed, as their fathers before them, in Enlil's imminent return. The old sinful world overrun by infidels had been scorched away 2 centuries earlier, clearing and cleansing the planet and making it a fit place for him to rule again. But in Resura's lifetime, there had been no foreshadowing of his return, and he knew that as old age crept upon him, he should not expect communications, much less miracles, from his god. Over the rhythmic cadence of the chanting, Resura heard a new sound, a faint, high-pitched whine so distant that he couldn't really be certain he heard it, or that it wasn't a mosquito buzzing too close to his ear. As he led his brethren toward the spiral, he felt a tingling, pins-and-needle prickling all over his body. Lurching to a halt, Amner bumped into him as Gudea trod on his heels. None of them spoke. They only stared at the hazy, blurred shimmer arising from the center of the mosaic, from the Eye of Enlil. The shimmer became a fluttering flare of light, like a flame flower blooming up and out of the mosaic. The air throbbed. The three priests gazed at the mosaic, frozen in place. Gudea was the first to drop to his knees and prostrate himself. After a moment, Amner dropped flat beside him. Rasura slowly lowered himself to his knees, joints popping, but he didn't fall face down. He kept his eyes on the flower of wavering luminescence. Within it, four dark figures stood back to back. At their heels, resting atop the Eye of Enlil, gleamed a shape very much like a pyramid crafted of smooth, gleaming metal. It appeared to be only 1 foot in overall width. When the echoes faded, Rasura became aware of himself, still kneeling, sweat drenching his face beneath his mask. In a far corner of his mind, it seemed strange that he didn't fall into a faint after what he had just witnessed. There could only be one explanation for the materialization from the Eye of Enlil. Rasura opened his mouth and spoke the words in the ancient language that he had learned so many years before, during his apprenticeship in the priesthood. The rituals of those who from heaven to earth came were old even before Enoch lit the first sacrificial fire. Though a cipher to anyone else listening, the words translated as follows.
To Kernugi, land of no return, Tiamat was determined to go. To the Dark House, dwelling of Anu's god, on the road where traveling is one way only. To the house where those who enter are deprived of light, where dust is their food, clay their bread. Tiamat, when she arrived at the gate of Kernugi, addressed her words to the keeper of the gate. Open your gate for me, or I shall raise up the dead, and they shall eat the living. Open your gate, or the dead shall outnumber the living.
I am the High Priest Leader of Nippur. I await your orders and guidance. I bid you welcome, Eyes of Enlil.